This morning on our call-in show, we welcome School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto, and also joining us at our roundtable is John Chung, who's with the Department of Education's Facilities Branch. He's here to talk specifics about the physical shape of our campus. Welcome to you both.
Aloha, Catherine. Thanks for having us.
Morning.
You know, Superintendent, it's hard to believe that it's been 2 years since you took this job. How are you doing?
Starting my third year and absolutely loving it. This is a wonderful community.
And I know you've had a chance to visit all the islands. You're probably on your, probably third pass.
Yeah, so I've visited about two-thirds of our schools and hope to finish up with about 75, 80 school visits this year so that I'm actually looking at each school individually and meeting with teachers and parents and faculty members there, our leadership, and getting a firsthand view of what's happening in education.
And talk about our strategic plan, because we had talked with you earlier this summer about this rollout of the Promise Plan. Where are we at on that?
So I'm excited because we finished our first round of receiving feedback from nearly 3,000 individuals. We are taking a very different approach to our strategic plan. Rather than setting goals for the next 10 years, what we're saying is we're going to create a 10-year vision plan around five promises to students. So we're excited about these five promises. We've received feedback, and so we completed the first round on that review.
Okay, so then what's the plan as far as feedback on what you've come up with so far?
So based on the community feedback, which has been extremely positive, we are now taking that feedback to create the first full draft of the strategic plan that will give a 10-year look at our priorities. So our five promises are focused on Hawaii, really couching ourselves on our cultural and local values. A second promise is around equity, ensuring equitable access to quality education for every child in Hawaii. Our third promise is around school design, really paying attention to how each school is designed with a local context and allowing this diverse portfolio of schools approach, and we can talk further about what that means. Our fourth promise is empowerment, which is shifting empowerment to the school level so that principals and teachers and staff at the local level can make decisions and be empowered to make curriculum design decisions. And our fifth promise is around innovations, innovating in partnership with business and industry to really try to retain our youth capacity here in Hawaii, get them excited about staying here and seeing career pathways that are viable for them.
You know, we are getting into, I think, the hottest months of the year. And, you know, John, maybe you can talk about the efforts that we've got to cool our classrooms, because that was a big priority of the governor's, because the kids can't really learn in really hot classrooms.
Right. So one of the programs we rolled out is the school-directed AC program, in which we are partnering with the schools to get window AC units in the classrooms as quickly as possible. Schools have always had the ability to, or many schools have had the ability to fundraise or receive donations for air conditioning units. The challenge has been validating if the classrooms had enough electrical capacity. So the facilities department is partnering with them in that we are conducting these assessments and then letting them know where and how many, which classrooms and how many AC units they can install, and then giving them the ability to self-help at that point.
We rolled something out that was tied to solar panels.
Yes, that was part of the governor's 1,000 classroom initiative. We put together a PVAC system. That system was chosen largely to the because of the electrical capacity issues. There are a lot of classrooms that we just didn't know whether or not they had the capacity, and rather than let that be a stumbling block, we went the other way and found a system that would just completely avoid that. So we managed to get all those out. In hindsight, it proved to be a little complicated system. We're having some issues with them, but we are working with our teams to resolve them. And as of today, I'm very happy to say I think our team is making good progress and we're finding solutions. The next step for us is just to start implementing and getting these systems back in operation.
My understanding is that I think it's Maui County is seeing some issues with that. Can you go into that a bit?
Some of the systems were not designed to be air conditioning to the point where it gets the classroom down to 72 degrees. We really don't want to see kids walking in with sweaters. That's just too cold, in our opinion. So we're trying to get them to, it's comfortable. But being that it is a PVAC system that operates on batteries, we're limited to how often, how long the systems can run and to what temperatures they can be dropped to. So we've had some issues where perhaps it's just a misunderstanding, but the systems are being asked to cool to 72 for much longer than they should be. And we're finding that, you know, as designed, the systems just can't accommodate that. So we're having issues.
So they're burning out basically faster than
Well, not necessarily burning out. The batteries are being depleted and then not having an opportunity to recharge. So those are the kind of things that we're working through. And they are complicated systems. A lot of these systems just need to be reset. But the problem is you need to know which device to push the reset button on, and that's not very intuitive. So it's a learning curve, and we're working through it right now.
And Superintendent, what have you seen as you've gone around to the different islands?
Well, you know, one of the things in terms of the cooling and specifically is that for those who received new AC units, certainly there's excitement and thank you, and let's make sure that we can expand on this. And for those classrooms that are not cooled right now, we know that there's an increased interest and demand because there's the haves and the have-nots right now. But there's also there's the training that John talked about, there's a capacity issue, and there's a mixed use kind of approach that we're using so that these are viable options moving forward that can be sustained. So that's on the AC side. In terms of what's happening in the classrooms, I'm really excited about the engagement that teachers are collaborating around to bring in new innovative approaches. Creating maker spaces, introducing students to STEM areas, introducing units of study around sustainability and really connecting to what's happening here in Hawaii, providing opportunities for students to really expand the concept of the classroom beyond the four walls, to go out into community and be involved with design thinking approaches so that they're taking challenges or problems or questions from community, coming back to the classroom and engaging in problems, solutions, and looking at how do we as young people can be part of creating solutions for community.
Right, you want to spark their curiosity
and bring
innovation.
Meaning.
Yeah.
Bring meaning to the instruction. And I think that's really where we're headed with the Hawaii public school system, and I'm excited about that instructional approach. It's very powerful.
Okay, we have a call on the line, a couple calls. Mindy from Hilo, what's on your mind?
Hi, guys. Classroom temperature is also the topic. Without increasing electricity bills, the color of the roof, white roof, will cool buildings. Why hasn't this been done, and how can we implement this?
Absolutely. Cooling, a white roof does result in cooling temperatures. It's just a matter of funding at this point. We are trying to maintain our roofs and re-roof them as the need arises. We have done some pilot tests with painting of the roofs to reduce temperatures, but what we're finding is we need to balance that with proper insulation. Without getting to the details, it's a system that needs to be put together, and that starts to add to the cost. So while painting the roofs will get you the cooling that you need, it does result in some other issues that we need to address on the building envelope side, which does cost money and does take time to resolve.
You know, I do recall at my son's school at Wilson, they painted the roof, and we had the PTA, and they said, we'll raise money for you and buy the air conditioners. But the whole idea of, okay, do we have the capacity in the school to deal with the extra load? And what's our electric bill going to look like? I think Mindy had raised that issue. And that's always a concern because, you know, those bills are expensive.
They're expensive. We have a fixed budget that we work under. We also have, as a state, we have sustainability goals that we need to meet. And so there's this just collective responsibility towards how much energy we're demanding out of the public school system, along with other state agencies, just being part of this collective citizenry, being responsible to the costs and also to that demand on the electric load. So we're looking at things like heat mitigation, heat abatement approaches as well, and there's multiple approaches that we're using in that area, whether that's removing of hot air and fans and other systems, depending on where you are, because Mindy from Hilo is going to have her story around what it's like to teach or to live in Hilo, which has different, you know, air quality and conditions and heat conditions than another area in the state. And so really differentiating our approach based on where that school is in the state.
And I think it's one of the most amazing things about Hawaii is all the microclimates. You know, each school has
Absolutely.
Their own challenge. And then, John, is there anything that you see just with procurement, the challenges of procurement when you're actually trying to do some of these different things?
It takes time. We need to follow procurement law, which we have a low bid system, and we're putting out these projects and giving all the contractors an opportunity to bid on them. We do have the job order contracting program, which we can conduct a lot of the procurement exercises up front, and that allows us to move quickly onto to doing contracting work for specific types of activities.
Now, I know that the DOE has struggled with repair and maintenance for a long time, and that's probably tied into this whole procurement issue. But what have we done to help make our system more efficient?
I mentioned the job order contracting program. That's really the right now the biggest tool that we have. It provides us an additional channel to go out and get repairs done at our schools. It accelerates the procurement process for us so that we can go out and accomplish a lot of projects in a short amount of time.
Can you give some examples of where you've been able to cut the time?
We focused on roofs. That was our biggest challenge. So some recent statistics that we've pulled together, what ordinarily would have taken months, if not years, we've managed to cut it down to a matter of weeks. I think one statistic I have is a 10,000 square foot roof, which is about an 8-classroom building. We can get it contractor on site, complete the work, and get off the site in about 18 days.
Okay, so it's a way to be able to tackle that backlog.
Yes.
Do you know where we're at roughly with the backlog?
I believe it's still upwards of 800 million, but we've already processed in less than a year close to $20 million through the job order contracting program, and we're gearing up to utilize the funds in this next appropriate budget cycle to continue that effort.
And Superintendent, what were your kind of general impressions as you were going around the different schools?
In terms of school facilities,
yeah.
Catherine, the our school buildings are, you know, 50 years and older, and keeping up with the demands of the facilities is quite a lift for the state, not just for the DOE, but for all of our state buildings. What I am finding is when I am going to schools and meeting with custodians and meeting with the local team, they are doing a fantastic job of maintaining buildings as best they can. At the same time, keeping up with what classrooms need, and bathrooms, roofs, paving. Those are things that are very evident to, when you go onto a campus, the kind of need they have. So we are, you know, we're all over the place. We have schools that have been updated, and we appreciate the legislature's support and funding on an annual basis. Last year, they gave us the greatest funding that we've had in terms of our CIP allocation, so we appreciate that. And they also tied in our job order contracting work with how they are providing funding. So we're also pleased with $70 million for the year that we have to expend through job order contracting. So that's there holding us to what we said we're going to be doing on expediting some of these projects. But schools are managing within what they have. And for the schools that are our older buildings that have had the least amount of work done on there, yes, you can see the wear and tear. At the same time, what I'm seeing instructionally is fantastic. And I do, you know, give a shout out to my teachers and principals and custodial staff and support staff for the tremendous work that they're doing to support community and create these positive environments.
Okay, well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Our guests in our studio are Hawaii Superintendent of Schools, Christina Kishimoto, and John Chung, DOE Facilities Administrator. If you're just joining us, you can join the discussion by calling 941-3689 or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Can you talk about school safety? because that's an important issue. We're seeing all these, you know, active shooter situations, which are very distressing on the mainland. But what are we doing here to keep our environment safe?
So we have school safety plans, and we have an overall Department of Education safety plan that is filed with Department of Defense as well locally. And we work across agencies. We have great partnerships with HPD and other agencies that work together, and we meet on an ongoing basis throughout the year to share information and to make sure that we adjust the plans in real time based on what we're seeing. We also have principals who also are trained and participate actively in ensuring the safety of their campus along with their school-based teams. I think, you know, what we're all seeing nationally, not just in Hawaii, is the struggles that we're seeing families and society around mental health issues, around homelessness, around families in crisis. That all spills into school campuses because either the kids come in with those kind of support needs as they need those supports in order to be ready to learn in school, or, you know, after, before school hours, and even during school hours, where community that shouldn't be coming onto campus may be coming onto campus. So we have had to deal with, at the end of last year, vandalism of some of our schools overnight primarily. So during the school day, we're seeing just a great track record, community working with us. We're not seeing kind of this trespassing during the day, but at night when the school is shut down, the kids are not there, staff are not there. We are seeing individuals come onto our campus, and our biggest struggle right now is about 10 to 15 schools that we're seeing across the state, primarily here in Oahu and Honolulu area, where we're seeing trespassers at night who are sleeping on the campus or breaking windows or bringing drug paraphernalia onto campuses and leaving it there. So our crew on campuses come in very early to make sure to walk the campus, to clean it. But I feel as if they're cleaning out stuff from campuses right. That really shouldn't be our work. I need them focused on other things.
Is there anything else from the facilities standpoint as far as keeping our schools safer, either with new school design or just dealing with the older campuses that we have?
We actively work with our school safety and security branch. They are involved in all of our new buildings and new school designs. They're an active partner in that design process, and so we try to incorporate the recommendations that they make.
So that includes signage. It includes making sure that we have modern equipment in terms of campus cameras and gates, just looking at that. We also have done school vulnerability assessments, and we will continue to do another set of those. And that's really a holistic team that looks at what's happening in community in terms of mental health, homelessness, family issues, as well as what's happening on campus in terms of what equipment we have and what signage we have.
You know, I think in Kamuki area, Crane Park, there's been a situation with homeless there on the sidewalks and in the district park, which is right up against Kamuki High School. And, you know, that's always a concern, you know, as a parent, that your kid, like you mentioned, if there's needles or paraphernalia that shouldn't be there, that's always a concern, I think.
Well, it's absolutely a concern for us as well. I think our biggest concern is, you know, during the day, we have a great environment and we have a good track record. It's overnight what occurs. Our schools and our school principals and teams actually have great relationships with the homeless that are consistently in an area and can often come to agreement, right, about respecting the campus. And so this is not to blame our homeless community who needs supports as well. But what happens is overnight around the perimeter of a campus, I worry about the amount of trash that's left and how we keep up with that. Our school is maintaining the school campus, but if you're on the sidewalk and it's full of trash, whether that's at a bus stop or that's where someone has encamped near the campus. That's the piece that I'm really asking for community to support us and really step up with community neighborhood groups coming together, walk the perimeter of a campus, help us keep it clean.
Is there anything you can talk about as far as like just Chapter 19, you know, if it's keeping contraband off campus? Where are we at with that?
So I'm excited that we have completed the review and revision of Chapter 19, which is really about behavior supports for our students who may make a bad decision but need to be supported and reengaged in school right away. Chapter 19 revisions have gone through the final review and approval by the board, is now in the governor's office for final sign-off, and then we will have revised Chapter 19. During this fall, we are providing training to our principals and our school-based team on the revisions.
Okay. We have a call coming in from Kalihi. Kevin.
Yes, this is for the superintendent. There's an article in today's Star Advertiser on cell phones in classrooms, written by a high school teacher. You know, there's a lot of evidence that these devices were designed to addict people and to distract them, and there's a lot of evidence that that is what's happening in classrooms. Former teacher, I've seen it myself, a big switch from before they appeared. Have you considered an across-the-board ban of phones in schools, and just as a way to give the classroom back to the teacher and the students? Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. Great question. Every school district is dealing with this. It's not just a cell phone. It's the social media and what impact that's potentially having on, you know, how kids are conversing and interacting and building positive relationships. So it's even bigger than the cell phones. But in terms of the cell phones, no, I'm not looking at an across the board ban, because what we would do as a result of that is end up collecting phones, storing them, figuring out whether the parent has to come and pick them up or whether it's a redistribution to the kids at the end of the day. It's really about teaching the kids and having good programming around appropriate times to use the cell phone and treating the kids with respect around kind of developing those skill sets around what you do in school and what you do with other decisions you're making around these personal items that you have. So we'll continue to really work on developing that positive culture and environment. We also have, you know, some schools that have tried things like there are times when you can pull out your cell phone and do a search on it, right? And those are things that I don't want to tie teachers' hands if they want to try using the device in some positive way for a particular class, for a particular lesson. So I think an across-the-board ban has been very spotty kind of success across the nation. And so we'll continue to work with teachers around how to support them and the classroom environment they want to create.
You know, a recent show that we had on mental health issues, we focused on a recent study that showed that a lot of our young people have mental health issues and either contemplated suicide or tried to commit suicide. And it's now not just in high school, but going into the middle school. And the DOE just rolled out a new app about bullying. Talk about that.
Yeah, so last year we had engaged our students and other community members around ways in which we can ensure that students have comfortable and safe ways to report if they are being bullied or if they know of someone who's being bullied. And we had a team of students help us design components of an anti-bullying or bullying notification app. And so any student can go in and either say who they are or do it anonymously, again, trying to increase and ensure that any bullying activity is reported. And sometimes you need to provide that opportunity for you know, an anonymous reporting approach. So we rolled out the app last semester. We are continuing this semester, and by the end of the fall, we'll have our first report on utilization, whether it's bringing up new reports that we were not aware of or new trends. But the idea is to create these safe environments. I'm excited that the student voice was used to design the app. So that it's very student-friendly. We started at secondary schools, and then we will, in about a year and a half, be rolling this out to elementary schools in an age-appropriate manner.
It's interesting. I mean, I agree with the caller that the use of cell phones is addicting. But if, like you mentioned, if we can look at it as a library access or how we could use it as a positive tool. I mean, I don't know, John, if you want to talk about just as a parent, how challenging it is to deal with new technology with your, you know, with your kids.
It is a challenge, but I'm often conflicted because as much as I harp on my son for being on his phone and playing his video games, it's really the new way for he and his friends to keep in touch and to socialize and communicate. So, you know, I don't want to take that away from him. So it's a balance that we struggle with, making sure that he has that opportunity, but yet doesn't become addicted to it.
Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We're talking about our public schools, and you can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a short break.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Airlines, celebrating 90 years, offering more than 170 flights a day between the neighbor islands. Reservations at hawaiianairlines.com.
On the next Fresh Air, our Emmy week continues with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who's nominated for her work on the comedy series Fleabag, which she wrote and stars in as a single woman who's a feminist but suspects she's a bad one. And we'll hear from Patricia Arquette and Ben Stiller, who are nominated for their work on Escape at Dannemora. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, following On Point.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up on the next On Point, is it time to end the filibuster? That requirement for a supermajority of 60 votes to pass legislation or confirm presidential nominees in the Senate. We'll hash it out. Plus, we'll talk with Stacey Abrams about voter suppression and 2020 politics. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, following The World.
You are back with The Conversation. We have a call coming in from Honolulu. Joe, you're on the line. Hi, Joe, you there?
Hello, for the superintendent.
Yes, what's your question?
Well, it takes a little explanation. I am personally aware of a situation where there's a child that is reporting abuse to her school counselor, and she's reported abuse that is so severe the child is also reporting suicidal thoughts. This abuse is being perpetrated by one of the child's parents, and the school counselor is not making any records of any kind of what the child is reporting to the school counselor. And I know these people are all mandatory reporters, so I'm kind of confused as to why that would be happening.
Right, because you want to help. You want to help. So, Superintendent, you know, what's the best advice for someone in a situation like this?
So, Joe, thanks for the question. Certainly, you can also play a role. I can't speak to the specific question about whether records are being kept or not, but certainly you're correct. We are all mandatory reporters of any child abuse or youth abuse. And so as an individual who knows about this situation, you can also place a call to the principal. Each school also has a complex area superintendent that they are a part of. And so that complex area superintendent, so there are multiple layers here available who are all mandatory reporters. We work with other state agencies to provide immediate support or investigation of the situation.
And, you know, we've had cases on the mainland, you know, whether it's a case of violence, active shooter. There was a discussion at one point about locks on the classroom doors. And John, maybe if you can talk about that, because I think that was proposed about a year ago. But is that feasible?
It really is a challenge. We have probably over 10,000 classrooms. And if you look at every door, that's 20,000 doors. What's being asked for are kind of new modern locks that will allow teachers to lock the door from within and during an active shooter event, but also has measures to prevent the students from creating havoc by locking teachers out and things like that. So these are proprietary locks. They're very expensive, and a lot of times it's not just a matter of installing the lock. It requires replacing the entire door and frame, so it's a costly measure to go this route. So we've been looking at it. We're trying to find more cost-effective ways to do it. Simpler ways may not be as fancy as these locks that are being proposed, but we think it can be as effective.
You know, then again, the cost, right? I mean, so many schools, so many doors, and what's the best policy?
It's also not just about the cost. If someone were to say, you know, I'll donate the money and here it is, and let's put these new door frames in with the door locks, it's also about the safety approach that we are engaging in based on how our schools are designed and what our communities want in terms of approaches. It's just like some districts nationally have done, they have gated out their entire school. They've put automatic locks so that at a certain time of the morning, if you're not in school, you have to be buzzed in. So there's different approaches that have been used. We are an island state with particular school models that are much more open and have a little more fluidity with the community, with kids going out and serving in community and community coming in and being part of the co-teaching. I think we've taken a different approach to engaging with community, all eyes and ears paying attention to safety matters, ensuring that we have the mental health wraparound supports for our kids, making sure that our staff are well-trained. If an emergency situation were to occur, that there are different ways to respond. So I think when we have one approach used by one district, we have to be very careful that we don't just assume that then it's just a money issue and place that same approach.
Right, it's not one size fits all.
It really isn't. And I've taught, I've led in three different districts, all three districts and even the boards of education of those districts have had very different mindsets and approaches that are aligned with that community's values around safety, around how to engage community, and have used different approaches.
We have a call coming in from the Big Island. Joseph from Volcano, what's on your mind?
Thank you. Pleasure to speak with you, Superintendent. Something that happened with me, I grew up in the 50s in Oklahoma. And we had once a month something called a lyceum number, in which somebody, usually a scientist and was really smart, would come by and for 1 hour wow us with different kinds of scientific phenomena. And I know it stimulated a large number of my classmates into seeking scientific careers. My suggestion is to recapture the ex-science teachers, junior high and high school science teachers. We've turned them out to pasture and give them no attention, and they're full of incredible amounts of information. They could go around to schools, grade schools, junior high and high schools, and perform these lyceum numbers, and it would add to the quality of experience in the educational system. I can guarantee that part.
Thank you for that, Joseph. Tapping the minds out there, our kapuna, you know, getting the kids excited.
Joseph, I'm absolutely in agreement with you. There may be more things happening than you're aware of, and I'll share those, but certainly we're always open to expanding upon this. We have a leadership institute, and our leadership institute is internal staff and also retirees who work with inducting and supporting and training our new employees coming in, from teachers all the way to the leadership role. We have guest speakers in classrooms. We have who are retirees. We also have students who go out into community to do project-based learning. And a lot of the folks who are leading these opportunities out in community are former DOE employees who are doing work around sustainability, who are working in our maker spaces, who are helping us also to design out classrooms in different ways. So we continue to look for ways to connect with folks who have certainly expertise in the science areas, but really across our STEM areas in technology, engineering, concepts as well, and looking for additional support, especially in math, which is a priority for us. And so, yes, if there are ideas and individuals, send them our way. We would love to continue to expand upon this.
Can we talk about the teacher shortage? I mean, what needs to be done in order to deal with this? Because at all levels, we just need the teachers. And I know as a parent, I want a passionate teacher. I want someone who loves, you know, what they're doing. I mean, I recall at Wilson, there was a fabulous teacher, Mrs. Walkie. A shout out to her. You know, she's probably still teaching. And I want a teacher that's engaged, that cares about the students, not someone who just wants an easy job and is going to play substitute, you know.
If you want an easy job, it's not teaching, I tell you that much, and you can speak to any of our kumu. I will say that we have incredible teachers in the Department of Ed. The challenge is we don't have enough of them. And also the challenge is that teaching in the public education system continues to become more and more complex as we look to also provide a lot of community supports and services to our public education systems. And I really need my teachers to be focused on creating that great instructional environment, which means that there are also non-teacher roles that we really need support around, and we need to provide that opportunity to hire those partners to come in and work with us. But in the classroom, we have, you know, a demand of 1,200, 1,300 teachers that we need a year due to retirement. And also teachers going on to other roles. And I think thinking about teaching as a lifelong profession, we have to think differently today. We have young people who go into teaching, MA, 10 years into teaching, want to switch careers. And that happens across every industry. And we shouldn't think that teaching is you know, exempt from the fact that employees are working in very different ways in community today, making decisions to work two or three career paths. And so we have to think differently about how we structure these opportunities. But we're also an island state, which means we can't recruit from across, you know, the state lines from someone else. You know, there's a lot of kind of borrowing and stealing from each other on the mainland, and that doesn't happen here. We have to grow our own teachers, and we do have a grow your own teacher program here. We thank the legislators, especially Senator Kidani, who's been at the forefront of ensuring we get funding for this program. We have a troops to teacher program, so military retirees often retiring at a very young age, looking for a second career. Helping them to understand the pathway to come into teaching or to have their spouses come into teaching. We also have a program of teacher academies at our high schools that we're growing to help our high school students start their teacher certification program while in high school so that we can retain our own students to remain in teaching in this profession here in Hawaii and to see it as a viable career path.
What about the pay? Because, you know, it is pretty shocking, you know, when you see how much you have to make in order to not be considered low income in Hawaii. And it's very difficult with the housing challenges, you know, better pay for teachers so they're, you know, they're more competitive out there because we don't want to see a brain drain. You know, we do see teachers leave.
Absolutely. So we see teachers who live in more of a joint ohana environment. They have that network and support. When we have our other teachers who don't necessarily have a multi-family kind of home environment, house environment, they're trying to rent or buy on their own. That teacher pay does not go far enough. And one of the things I found in the last two legislative sessions that I've been involved with is that I need very specific data to go to the legislature with to talk about what the delta is between our current pay and competitive pay that will help to mitigate this gap, this teacher gap right now. And so I've contracted actually with a third party to do a study on Hawaii teacher pay that will be available in December that will take into consideration and adjust for cost of living in Hawaii. And it's that study that I will use, our HSTA, our teachers union will use as well. I'll be sharing that with them to go to the legislature to say, This is the delta. This is the amount of money we need to have a competitive salary and also a salary that allows viability to live here in Hawaii. We want to retain that capacity.
Are we doing anything to attract more teachers to the rural areas where there might be, fewer teachers, qualified teachers interested in
Absolutely.
Going?
Absolutely. So we do have differentiated pay, and we have stipends anywhere from $3,000 all the way up to $10,000 of additional pay. Hard to fill, or if you have national board certification, we are providing those differentials, and they help. At the same time, the pipeline of future teachers is not filled enough, so we produce about 600 teachers a year, but DOE alone needs about 1,300. So that doesn't count the private schools who are also looking for teachers. And so we're not producing enough teachers here in our state for the demand.
And I know at one time, I think the University of Hawaii Board of Regents met with the Department of Education School Board to talk about how can we help, College of Education produce more teachers and higher quality teachers and to get certified teachers.
Absolutely. And University of Hawaii is a major partner with us in this work. And also continues to look at new certification areas. We have a new commitment towards instruction K through 12 in computer science, which means another demand area in addition to other teacher demands that we have. And so working with the University of Hawaii around these preparation programs. I also think that as a state, as a system, we need to be willing to think about teacher certification in a very different way. We have a system that's been around forever, right, nationally. And I think we need to think differently about how you access a teacher line, how you get trained while teaching, and create different flexibilities in our policy structure.
Okay, we have a call from Hilo. Sue, you're on the line. Hi, Sue, are you there? Oh, maybe not. We might have lost her. She had a question about the school year, which starts in August, ends in May, which includes two of the hottest months of the year. Why is it structured this way? And I think it goes back to the agriculture system from many moons ago.
It does. And at the same time, as many as we may have individuals who say, can we shift it so we're starting later, right before Labor Day or right after Labor Day, I think we have more individuals who are pushing and saying we really like starting earlier and ending earlier and having that flexibility during those summer months, especially when they have Ohana on the mainland or in other places where they're traveling internationally to get together with family and being able to get on those flights early.
Okay. Call from Maui. Hunter, you have a question.
Yeah, I had one idea, which is, what is the potential, I don't know the legal reality of it, but of making students have to have an application for their smartphone? And if their smartphone's going to work on a school campus, it allows for parental contact or guardian contact, and then the search surfaces that the school approves, but allows no other social media to come into the phone at that point. And or if you there's some kind of disciplinary or whatever, take a phone away if it doesn't work, like if someone's somehow utilizing an outside network at that moment. But then the distraction goes away. You eliminate all texting and social media structure, so on and so forth.
So, Hunter, thank you for your idea. There is such a thing as kind of a pocket you can put a phone into that disables it. Such as when you're driving, and there are other I think very clever innovations that people have developed. For every innovation you develop, there are just as many innovations to to counter that. And so I still really believe that it's really around the education, it's really around the engagement of young people, around setting the standards for that learning community and developing that buy-in so that teachers and students are working together. We find that when teachers engage students in developing the norms of engagement, the norms of what are the rules around whether technology is allowed or not allowed or how it's used, that when teachers give students voice in developing that at the beginning of the year, that there's much more success with students actually following the rules that they have developed. And so we see that in a number of high schools and middle schools, and so we'll continue to really build on that approach of student voice.
How are we doing as far as the internet capability in our schools? I don't know if you can address that at all, John.
I think we're making great strides in it. We have probably one of the most robust networks in the nation. We're continuing to expand on that network. That really is the charge of our Office of Information and Technology section. But facilities works closely with them to ensure that anytime we have a project going out, that we, to the extent that we can, provide the infrastructure to allow for future expansion of the classrooms for broadband and internet access. In particular, we lay a lot of fiber optic cable, which enables that.
And are we still leasing computers? What's the snapshot in our schools?
The purchase of computers has become so accessible. The price has gone down tremendously. So we have lots of one-to-one situations. We have lots of technology in our schools. It's really less about whether we have the technology in the schools and how teachers are trained to utilize the technology and provide an opportunity to design ways to extend learning opportunities in different ways using that technology. We have new computer science standards, and our goal is to be fully implemented with the computer science standards by 2022. So that's right around the corner. We're working on articulating K through 12 experiences around coding, around using graphing on technologies, using apps in our classrooms for learning, having students develop apps and so forth.
Do we have the open online gradebook where the teachers...
We do have an online gradebook.
Is that available to everybody or just select schools?
It's available to everyone. I can't answer whether everyone is using it, but yes, it is available to everyone. We are also doing other modernization of our computing systems. Right now, we just transitioned out of... Probably the entire state is celebrating. We finally transitioned out of Lotus Notes and gone to Google Mail. We probably should have done that, 20 years ago. We have a whole system modernization approach that includes our mail system, email system, our financial management system, our HR system as well, again, becoming much more sophisticated and much more aligned with standards of business and industry within our public school system.
Right, because it's important to be able to keep up with the technology and to be able, like you said, to spit out those reports. So you have a handle on, if we have a bureaucratic system, we have to kind of know what's happening across the state.
But there's a whole business side of the house to to a DOE system of this size and scope. And so that's a commitment that I have to modernizing our systems and getting away from being seen as a bureaucratic government, slow to change system, but really becoming this modern system that's really supported and aligned with business and industry standards.
Okay. And I should probably ask, because I know earlier this year we saw a lawsuit on Title IX, and I know you're probably limited just with what you can say legally, but can we just talk about, what are we doing to address those inequality issues?
The facilities branch has been working closely with our civil rights compliance branch and collaboratively taking a look at what our compliance requirements are and finding ways to achieve compliance as quickly as we can. The legislature did appropriate a large sum of money to address some of these issues, and we are actively programming those projects and trying to get them underway so that we can meet our requirements.
Is a procurement an issue in
No, not necessarily. It's just a matter of getting the projects out, designed, and bid and constructed.
Okay. And we're also excited that in late September, we have a statewide conference for leaders around Title IX. the work that we have a Title IX committee, and they're an advisory committee that includes experts from the fields, internal staff members all working together to continue to look at our data, to look at not just our data in terms of compliance, but saying, you know, what do we want to design for in terms of opportunities for our students, and how do we plan out progress towards that vision. And so we have a statewide conference coming up for leaders, and we also have training that occurred all summer for our school-based staff around Title IX.
Okay, and we only have a couple minutes left, but is there anything you want to say? I mean, I know we had the recent Supreme Court decision on immersion schools on Lanai.
Yes. So, you know, this is a case that's still active. We will be watching it very carefully, but internally and also with our external partners, including partners like Kamehameha Schools that's been working with us for many, many years, we have a commitment to our Kaiapuni program. And for us, the DOE, the critical factor here is how quickly we can build capacity. How many more teachers can we get certified, or how many community members can we bring in and prepare to, even without certification, to be part of our program. And so this is a program that's being developed. What we're excited about is that demand continues to increase. And so, yes, we absolutely believe in this dual language approach in our public school system, but also statewide in other areas.
Okay, we have about a minute left. Any final thoughts?
I just want to say how excited I am that the community really owns the public school system as theirs. And as long as we have that community engagement and commitment, we're going to continue to be a public school system that's a state-of-the-art education learning environment for all students.
Okay. And anything on your wish list, John?
No, we just ask for the public's continued patience and collaboration with us. We're trying the best we can to get to all of the needs, and we greatly appreciate their collaboration with us.
Okay. All right. Well, we would like to thank our guests, John Chung and School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto. And we thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. If your call didn't make it on the air during today's discussion, contact the talkback line and leave your comments. That number, 808-792-8217. Send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the Conversation Podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.